Welcome to Book Talk for Book Talk, a literary podcast where we've been deep diving into your favorite novels. This is Jack.
And I'm Amy. And our listeners love to share their thoughts and theories via email and voicemail, so we're sharing them via our weekly mini episodes.
The views expressed by the hosts and listeners are entirely their own and in no way represent the thoughts or intentions of the original author. This podcast is a discussion shared to spark thought and conversation on the characters and themes of this novel.
Spoilers may be discussed with or without warning. Explicit language, as well as themes of sex, violence, abuse, death, and depression, will recur throughout this podcast. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to our mini episode series. During each mini, we'll be reading listener feedback and theories, as well as discussing all things Sarah J. Maas, including her ACOTAR, Crescent City, and Throne of Glass series. Are you ready to read some emails, Amy?
Sure am.
Do you know what makes this episode so special? I wonder if you can actually guess what makes me feel like that this is a special episode.
Because we have an intern?
Because I'm blonde now.
Oh.
All right, let's get into it. This is from Dallas. I think Elaine and Lucien are going to be key in stopping Kosche. It's already been established and discussed that there is more to their characters as well as their minds. This is referenced of Lucien multiple times throughout the series and hinted with Elaine. I think they will have to work together and potentially go off together to stop him, which will allow them to connect and form a bond, which I personally hope will allow them to put the mating bond aside and give them an opportunity to choose each other because they genuinely want to.
I feel like Jack's face is like, ah. Whether or not Elaine and Lucien choose each other, I think that this makes the most sense for what comes next for all the storylines that have not been realized yet.
Because Kosche isn't done. Like,
no.
We're coming back to Kosche.
Obviously. And Vasa. I bet Moore has a part to play in it. So...
yeah, Moore's going to end up with Vasa because Moore was with a human queen before.
Oh, interesting.
Right?
Interesting.
And it's almost like she gets to be with the human queen that she wanted, which means Vasa will somehow end up immortal. Because don't they all? Well, right now, Vasa's the only one that's not immortal.
Right.
Jurian's human, but like he's cauldron made, so he could probably live for a long time.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
And if nothing else, he's at least 500 years old.
Yeah, exactly. But I mean, I think it makes sense where they're going to have to force proximity.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Force proximity is 100% going to be a thing.
Yeah.
Wouldn't be surprised if the one bed trope comes back into play.
I demand the one bed trope to come back. There is not enough one beds in this world.
There should be more one beds.
Yes. Okay. As I was writing my romance novel and I was outlining it, which is based off of personal experiences, I've been in the one bed trope.
Yeah, I know you have.
I didn't realize I was in my own trope. I didn't realize that that trope could end with a non-happy ending.
Oh, I'm sorry.
No, it's cool. It's cool. It's not. It's fine. It'll be good for Elaine and Lucien. I'm happy for them. Happy and thrilled.
So funny that you never realized you were in a one bed trope.
I
think about it every time you tell the story.
Never thought of it. Never thought of it.
It's fair.
I didn't think of anything.
Because you were hurt by the moment.
I mean, who is in one bed, who's in the middle of a one bed trope,
and doesn't take advantage,
reaches over for you, and then does nothing?
I don't know. This email is from JD Ventures. I listened to the episode recently where y'all were discussing how the inner circle was being, for the lack of better words, insensitive to Feyre and Lucien's rescue slash return to Valaris after Feyre escaped to the Spring Court after leaving it in shambles and inevitably in Highburn's hands. They also critique Feyre's choices, all while she's basically still in shock. One thing I wanted to add to both of y'all's already amazing points is maybe they are being harsh with Feyre in her approach to this sort of war game. You know, spying, deceit, and calculation, at the expense of one's self and bodily harm, because it's regular for them. In a way, all of the Inner Circle is battle-worn, war-experienced, and have warrior mentalities. That being said, maybe they've forgotten the horror and shock they all experienced individually after their own first experience, like Feyre's. Maybe this is why they're all being so calm and casual, and at times critiquing Feyre's choices while in the Spring Court.
Interesting. I like that. I mean, it is fair. They all, like, are battle-worn and torn.
Yeah.
You know, with trauma. I forget that, because they're just such, like,
Happy-go-lucky.
Yeah, what are those plush animals that everyone loves?
Squishmallows?
Yeah, they're like the Squishmallows of warriors.
Yeah, they do have, for 500-year-old battle-worn individuals, mm-hmm. they do have rather sunny dispositions.
Yeah.
But they do also come across as flippant. And mm-hmm. and maybe 500 years is a long time to remember what your first experience is like. And sometimes they're like, oh, yeah, that was like how my first experience was as well. But they don't actively remember that.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, and it could be that because they are so old, they're like, you know what? Sometimes you have to kind of be careless. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you kind of have to be like, eh, it happens.
Yeah, yeah. But that only comes with time and experience, as any situation in real life.
I was going to say, it's how I handle my dating life. A little bit more flippant now of like, eh, sometimes you just got to make a joke of it. It's
yeah,
fine.
Yeah. I mean, it's like any type of rejection. The more you yeah. get rejected, the more you're like, well, that whatever.
Yeah. I mean, it's true. Yeah. It turns from rejection to like, wow, I can't believe someone could be so dumb.
Yeah. Like, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
It really is. I think that's fun. You know what? Compare dating to 500 years of war. And I think you've got a good comparison.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's true. Especially your dating life, because you've had a more extensive dating life than I have. I've been very isolated.
My 20s was a battle.
It was.
It was a full battlefield. I've
seen the numbers.
I know. What?
I'm just, in terms of how many dates you've been on.
Okay, cool, cool. Let's specify here which numbers.
Number of dates you've been on. Number of first dates you've been on.
Thank you. And it's, I'm sorry, I'm still thinking about that one time we were driving and we were talking about numbers.
Oh, man.
And you thought I was talking about how many guys I've kissed.
And you were talking about
something else.
Something else.
And I was like, holy shit, Amy, how many do you think?
Basically, what happened is I accidentally slut-shamed Jack, even though that was not what I was talking about.
And there's no such thing as a slut.
There is no such thing as a slut, but I number-shamed Jack.
But just for the number of guys I've kissed, yeah, that's the funny thing is I just was like, wait, what? How many? How many?
That is the miscommunication trope we all hate.
Yeah, yeah. This comes from Kim. I was just listening to Mini Episode 6, and I had a quick little random thought about Elaine. So we know that she can see Vasa. She warns / tells everyone about a Firebird. What if she can still see Vasa, and in seeing Vasa, she sees Lucien? And she slowly starts to realize that he's not actually a terrible person, but sweet and smart and thoughtful and all the wonderful things he is. On top of sexy, and she starts to get jealous or curious. So now she gives him a chance and travels with the Band of Exiles.
I actually really like this thought. I think it might play out a little bit differently. I like the idea of Elaine continuing to be able to see Vasa and therefore by extension Lucien. I would love if Elaine has a vision of Lucien in trouble and her instinct is to go save him.
She will always have that instinct because they are mates.
Yeah, and she'll try to fight it, but the visions will keep coming.
But
and
also, then, like, how much of an asshole if you try to stop, save him? Like, it's part of the crew.
And then I would love it if the three Archeron sisters go off together to save Lucien.
Amy's, like, swinging her fists like a pirate. I don't know. Like,
like I'm skipping.
That's your skipping arms?
Well, I can't with all the equipment in front of me.
I'm going to have you skip later to see where your arm placement is. I absolutely adore this. I love the idea of Elaine getting jealous because I think Elaine is going to be the most, I don't want to say, I don't like extreme difficult emotions.
I was going to say difficult nut to crack.
I don't want to call her a shitty person because I can get pretty jealous. But like, I think she's going to be the most jealous. I think she's going to be the most stubborn. I think she's going to have like the most difficult personality traits, mm-hmm. which is going to say something because Nesta is kind of the queen of that.
Yeah.
But I think she's going to end up being more of the stubborn one, more of the jealous one. And mm-hmm. we're going to get that a lot more. I mean, it's based off of nothing other than the fact that, you know, we have to spice up her character a little bit.
Right.
And I love the idea of her seeing Lucien through Vasa. Also, it just kind of reminds me of, like, you know, the trope where you're trying to ignore them, but they're everywhere. Mm-hmm, they're at the grocery store. They're at
You just can't run away from them.
Exactly. But it's that with visions.
Yeah. Yeah. She definitely can't escape those.
Like, imagine if, like, just imagine the scene where she's having a vision of Lucian and she's like, God, not again. And then she just kind of clears her mind and takes a step forward and then bumps into him. And she's like, what are you doing? Why can't I get away from you?
I love that.
Yeah.
This email is from Stephanie.
People in your y'alls. I haven't said y'all this much since high school.
Y'all.
Y'all mentioned Feyre staying with Tamlin was a form of her punishing herself and even Tamlin feeling like it was his punishment as well, at least subconsciously. I saw it a little differently. There's a psychology behind making a big decision that makes the buyer react in one of two ways. They either end up having buyer's remorse and regretting the decision, or they double down and try to convince themselves that their choice was the best choice and nothing else could have possibly been as good. Sounds like somebody I know.
Wait, me?
Yeah. You double down a lot.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah, no, that's right.
I think Feyre definitely is going through the second reaction. She went through so much, and if she and Tamlin don't get their happy ending, it was all for nothing. Feyre also tends to equate her and Tamlin's happiness with Prithian's happiness, which just further illustrates the point. Tamlin equals everyone. So if Feyre and Tamlin don't end up together, then what was the point? And Feyre can't handle that since she knows it was worth it to save everyone. On a separate note, Tamlin being armed in Mist and Fury was more of a symbol of his PTSD to me than a symbol that he has his power back. It's like he has to have weapons in addition to his own self to be able to feel safe.
Ooh, I love that PTSD thought.
Yeah.
I love that.
It's a great point because he was unarmed the entire time under the mountain.
Yeah.
That it would be a safety thing. I think that's an excellent point.
A fantastic point. For the first one, yeah, I mean, like, it makes sense that Feyre would be like, no, if this doesn't work out, then this is, it has to work out. And I think that's very common.
Yeah.
Like, I get that.
I do that. Like, we all do.
I mean, yeah, and I did that in a relationship where I'm like, we've been together for so long. Why? Like, you know, I felt like I bounced before Feyre did, but it's I bounced before I got locked in a manor. And but no, I mean, yeah, like I feel like that's a very natural instinct to do.
Yeah.
It's like protectiveness. It's being protective of yourself and your own heart and your own mentality of like, no, like you spend time and energy and investment. I get Feyre.
Yeah, I do too. It's when you put that much time and energy into something, you want it to work because it does feel like it's all for naught. And if you're already in a bad headspace, you can't really fathom what that means for you as an individual. And yeah. I think it calls into question like an individual's self-worth too.
Yeah, yeah.
If I couldn't make this work, I can't make anything work. And then I'm worthless.
I'm surprised Rhys didn't have her recite the lines. Don't be sad that it's over. Be happy that it happened. And all these like mantras of like letting go is the best form of growth. You know, like every single like, are you trying to tell me something, Rhys? Like he just has a bunch of affirmations for her to write.
Instead, it's Rhys is sexy.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a different type of affirmation, but yes.
That's true.
yeah. Double down, Feyre. I get it. I respect it.
Yeah,
but,
I mean,
once I go opposite, I double down opposite.
Yeah, yeah, real fast.
Yeah, it's like, now I want no communication.
Do we need to cut that?
No. No, because I talk to my exes.
Yeah, yeah.
This email is from a different Kim. That's not how she signed her name. I just wanted to share my hot take / fan theory about Aerys. Here it is. I think that when Aerys sought out Mor as a wife, he was expecting her to be like the rest of the Court of Nightmares, cunning, politically minded, and seeking power through an advantageous marriage, just like the image that was, and still is, broadcasted to the rest of the world. Someone who could not only survive, but thrive in his court. Then he met her, a young female who was scared, soft, barely surviving in her home, and wouldn't last in his. And he may or may not have figured out her sexuality. I don't think he did, as she kept that well hidden, but it's a possibility. So he offered her an out. He planted the idea to ruin the marriage so he wouldn't be subjected to his family like he was. I don't think that he expected what was going to follow. I think that when he discovered more in the Autumn Court, he panicked. Surrounded by his father's men, he had no choice but to leave her there and hope someone came for her. I think that if Moore had no other use to Baron, then Moore would be killed for her actions. That would be perceived at best an embarrassment to Baron and his family, and at worst, traitorous, both resulting in her death.
I actually really like this idea that Eris planted the idea of Moore selling herself into Moore's head.
Yeah.
So that Baron couldn't be implicated in it.
I'm sure he said something like the lines of, I mean, now that that's in my head, because I love this idea, he could have easily said something as casually like, make sure you keep yourself pure for me.
Yeah.
Something like really snide or something like that.
Right. Or, you know, an offhanded comment between Eris and Baron that Moore overhears of like, are we sure she's not damaged goods?
Yeah.
Right. And that's his way. It's not a great way, but that's his way of helping her get out of this situation.
Mm-hmm.
I do like this idea that Eris probably didn't get a choice in the arranged marriage.
But I love the idea that he saw someone from a really messed up court.
Yeah, I agree. So that person could survive in the Autumn Court, because the Autumn Court is messed up.
Yeah.
I do like that thought. I think that's actually pretty ingenious.
Absolutely. To me, that makes the most logical sense.
Yeah.
And like, it's great politically, but it's also like, you know, they have that bad rep. You know, I don't have to love her, but she's at least going to be part of my team.
Right. Or I don't have to worry about taking care of someone. She'll be able to take care of herself.
Especially since he saw how his mother was treated and couldn't handle it, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then
he probably saw a lot of his mother in her.
Oh, like once he saw her for real.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Yes. I think you're right.
And he probably feels very protective of her because he's very protective of his mother.
I have a feeling, and I don't know if I made, you know how sometimes you make things, you know how I sometimes make things up in my head and I just kind of believe them to be true?
Yeah, we all do. Headcanons. Yeah.
Okay, so you do too.
Yes.
Cool. So remind me, I thought we knew that Eris let Rhys or Asriel know that Moore was there. Or did I make that up?
I think I can't remember. That feels right.
Right? Because it's like, how else would they have known about her being dumped at the Autumn Court?
It would have been revealed in Silver Flames.
Yeah.
And I can't remember off the top of my head.
Someone, can you guys?
Someone please correct us.
Yeah, please send us a DM or something. Yeah. Just be like, you're right.
Or you're wrong. This message is from Claudia. You guys keep mentioning, as well as a lot of other people on TikTok, that Feyre is an unreliable narrator and we cannot trust what comes out of her mouth. I feel like a better way to go about this is to remember that we are looking at things through her lens. This means that her thoughts and feelings are a direct result of her own experiences. These experiences were real and give her a different but still valid perspective on subsequent events as compared to others. While one of you is looking at things through a feminist perspective, the other is looking at events through a Marxist perspective. Although some of your analyses of events may differ based on the lens you're looking through, this doesn't automatically invalidate your partner's analysis. I think it's easier to write off Feyre's narration as unreliable instead of adding an additional layer of complexity. However, we have to realize that everyone has different experiences and has differing forms of evidence to back up what they claim to be true. We use our own experiences so we can make judgments that will aid in self-preservation, including mental, emotional, and physical. This is what Feyre is doing. Can we say her judgments are incorrect? No, she's the expert in this. We can objectively analyze situations and discuss how her own experiences could affect her current judgment, feelings, and actions. We cannot, however, call her unreliable. If her judgment was unreliable, she would not have grown and had the positive outcome we see throughout the rest of the series. I would call Feyre's narration open to interpretation and say that we're only seeing part of the truth. Saying unreliable insinuates a lie being told to us by the narrator. Feyre's not lying, she's just telling her truth.
I'm really happy that Claudia sent this to us because this is a note that we've received a couple times on social, through email, and it's, you know, it's on us for having not explained unreliable narrator, because that's something that we discuss a lot in literary analysis. And you know, what you're saying is absolutely spot on, Claudia. That's also the definition for unreliable narrator. But that's on us. Like, we didn't explain that.
Yeah. So when we say unreliable narrator, we're not saying Feyre's a liar. What we're saying is, what we're calling out is a writing device. Unreliable narrator is a writing technique that authors can use.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we perceive Sarah J. Maas using when she's writing from Feyre's perspective.
I liked how Claudia described it. It's a different lens. It's the narrator's lens.
Exactly.
And because we, you know, you're viewing it from a very, like, a fish bubble.
Yeah.
Is that the term? A fish lens. You know, you're looking at it from a smaller perspective, like, through directly the narrator. The reason why the term, and, like, we didn't token the term unreliable narrator. The reason why they call it unreliable is because you are viewing it through a lens. You are going through there. It doesn't, you know, it's not meant to imply that they're lying. It's more meant to imply that we're missing out on important details that they're not picking up.
Right, because we're only seeing things through their lens. If you look at it this way, in any story, there's an objective truth,
mm-hmm.
and the narrator only gives you their subjective truth.
Yeah.
We're only getting what the narrator is capable of perceiving. And sometimes that aligns and sometimes that doesn't align with what's really going on.
Yeah.
And it's not that they're willfully lying through their narration. It's that they're only capable of processing to a certain extent.
Yeah. And that's also very, I will say I do apologize. Like, we don't explain everything necessarily of, like, the lingo that goes into a literary analysis. It's the same way that, you know, you view things through the Marxist lens. What that means is the dynamic of power.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean
Karl Marx,
which is, like, kind of how it started. But that's also, like, not where we're at or anything
right,
like that.
Right.
So, you know, when I was, like, first explaining it to my mom, like, oh, yeah, the Marxist lens. She's like, what?
Excuse me.
Yeah. And I was like, oh, wait, no, let me explain it to you. So
I don't mean socialism and communism.
Exactly. So it is something like for whatever reason in the literary academic community, we have these pretty extreme terms.
Yes.
Like, unreliable. Yeah, I can totally see why someone would view that as calling them a liar.
Right.
When it's not, like, I love the term. I wish that was, like, the more accurate term of, like, the narrator's lens.
Or, like, a subjective narrator.
Yeah. But, unfortunately, that's, I don't know.
That's the lingo we were taught. That's the lingo we use.
Yeah. But I'm happy that you brought that up, Claudia.
Yeah, because I think it is confusing for a lot of people.
Absolutely. This comes from Isabella. I don't think Nyx should have been included in the series. I think that it takes away from Rhys and Feyre, and now they're just viewed as Nyx's parents. Tying into that, Nesta wouldn't have had to give up her powers.
Okay, this is an interesting thought, because I actually don't view Nyx as very important yet. So I personally don't view Feyre and Rhys as Nyx's parents. I just view them as Feyre and Rhys. And Nyx is just this random bean off in the corner.
So this is absolutely not what Isabella wanted us to get into, but I'm going to take, like, you know, a broader lens, and I apologize for taking this somewhere else. I think that can be fairly popular in society where we feel like when people have kids, they lose their identity.
Yeah.
And whether that's the parent themselves, I've heard plenty of parents say that they feel like they lost their identity.
Yep.
Or viewing someone of, like, wow, you lost all of your interests. You're now this child's parent.
Right.
I think that's kind of unfair to parents, except for the ones that do make it their personality trait. Then I'm like, oh, God. But no, I'm kidding. Parents are wonderful. But I think it just kind of comes into that societal concept, which is unfair to the parents.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we want to give them an opportunity, them being Feyre and Rhys, an opportunity to be like, you know, they're still people, like, people who have kids. They're not lost to the world.
Right. It's not that they're no longer individuals.
Yeah. You know, they might have different priorities. They might have, like, different things they need to focus on. And, you know, you and I, Amy, feel like it makes perfect sense that they had a kid.
Yeah, it makes sense from, because of what they've gone through, right? I did think about what you were talking about, the whole loss of identity as a parent.
Mm-hmm.
I do think from a narrative point of view and from the character development, especially after you read Frost and Starlight, it does make sense that the next step was to have children. Do I think Nyx is important to the story? No, not yet. He better fucking be eventually, because if he's not, then it is annoying.
Well, what's also hard is that Feyre and Rhys aren't meant to be the priority story anymore.
Right.
You know what I mean? But that's not because they had a kid.
Right.
Those two things happen. Like, they're not meant to be part of the story anymore, and they had a kid. One doesn't cause the other.
Right.
It's just you know, SJM saw their ending. I mean, their story kind of came to a conclusion.
Right.
And the rest of it, that's why we had Nesta. That's why we're going to have Elaine. And, you know, they're not off in the sunset, but I can understand why people view it as like, oh, now they had a kid and they're no longer important.
Yeah. I think if SJM had chosen to continue Rhys and Feyre's storyline, I think we would feel like they lose their identity, because their characters have kind of grown as far as they can grow in this universe. They've done a lot of growing. I honestly don't know what more SJM could put them through for them to continue to grow. And that's why
you're dragging out the story if you do that.
Right, right, right. And I think some people dislike Silver Flames because the narration's no longer from Feyre and Rhys's point of view and the story is no longer about them. But honestly, I don't know what you could do with them except to tear them apart.
Yeah, or, you know, risk their child and stuff. But I think we also have to just... And I don't want people to say, yeah, exactly. You have a kid and then you become nothing. It's like, no, it's just like, as a writer, you don't want to have to drag it out over and over again. Like, you just kind of have to accept, you know what? They developed. Doesn't mean they're done developing, but it's just not the forefront.
Right. The story SJM wanted to tell is done in terms of them.
Yeah. They're still going to grow. It's the same way that when we view Nesta in Wings and Ruin, there was a lot of growth happening off screen that we didn't get from Feyre's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And one day when we do Silver Flames, I'm sure we're going to catch all the growth that Feyre and Rhys are doing off screen, but we don't see because we're viewing it from Nesta's lens.
Exactly.
No, I hear you, Isabella. A lot of people have the same views, and just wait till we do Silver Flames. Maybe we'll end up agreeing. Maybe we'll change everyone's mind.
Yeah. I would say we don't even have to do Silver Flames. I bet we can do Frost and Starlight and change people's minds about Nyx.
Whoa. All right. All right.
I said what I said.
Season 3, Episode 5, Elaine's moon white dress was brought up. And I wanted to discuss the fact that, what is the moon? The moon reflects sunlight. So Lucien, as the source of the sun, Elaine is reflecting sunlight back. And also, in the Night Court, there is the stars, the night, and the moon. The moon, the only source of sunlight in the Night Court. That's what Elaine wears. I think it's important.
I don't think that they can see my face, Amy, mainly because this is a podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm pretty sure my jaw was dropped the entire time.
Oh, yeah. And you were like, your eyes were darting around the room like, what the hell?
Like, the answer will somewhere be in this room. Samantha, also known as
Creative LBD,
always comes in with some amazing theories and observations. And holy moly, this was another one. It makes sense.
Oh, yeah. I am so proud of you, Samantha, but also so annoyed with myself. You're right. We can't always assume that the moon is associated with the Night Court because the moon reflects the sun's light.
Yeah.
And who is light?
Lucien. Oh, my God. Yeah. Big fan. Big fan of that.
That's amazing. You know what I just read in the High Lords meeting?
What?
Lucian's mother's skin is called Moon White. Does she reflect the light of her sun or
she reflects Helion? Helion. Oh, my God. It's all coming together.
It is.
Oh, okay. Elaine, the innocent one, right? Moon. I wonder how deep SJM's going to go with the moon analogy, because what if she's more like Artemis,
ooh,
Diana?
Ooh, interesting.
We're talking Greek Roman goddesses who are hunters. Goddesses of war and the hunt. Yeah, hunt and bow and arrows and kind of a badass.
Yeah.
But also single and virginal. She chooses her virginity for a long time.
Yeah.
Granted, Elaine's not a virgin.
She might not choose a partner.
Yeah, until Lucien comes into the picture. Hey.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Don't resist this. You already joined. You joined us a long time ago.
I did. Thanks, Samantha. Thank you for listening to this mini episode of Book Talk for Book Talk. We encourage you to rate and subscribe to our show on your preferred podcast listening platform.
We would love to hear your thoughts based on today's conversation. You can submit your comments to our form at booktalkforbooktalk.com or via our Camflare voicemail system. Please visit booktalkforbooktalk.com for more information.
You can also follow us on TikTok or Instagram at the handle Book Talk for Book Talk. Bye!